Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Alchemy of Life broadcast. I am Jamil Graham, your host, and we are broadcasting on bbsradio.com on the 22nd day of the 9th lunation, September the 8th, 2012, in the Gregorian calendar. And the Alchemy of Light broadcast is a celebration and exploration of consciousness, how we feel and think in the very broadest of definitions. And today I'm very grateful and excited to welcome two very special guests with special messages to us, Lynn Woodland, who is the author of an absolutely outstanding book, Making Miracles, Create New Realities for Your Life in Our World. In this book that she has put together, she does a fantastic job of clarifying for us how the state of miraculous co-creation is actually normal. It isn't necessarily a woo-woo thing. It's actually what we feel and experience, what our consciousness becomes part of in our true awakening selves. And in the book, she gives us fantastic information. But we today are going to be introducing a fantastic program that she is just launching called the Making Miracles Project. And in the Making Miracles Project, she challenges us all to take our miracle-making prowess developing into our communities and taking this seed of consciousness to make the world a better place in service to create wealth, prosperity, abundance for all, in the full understanding that creating for all is creating for us at the same time. And this is what we're going to be sharing about today. In the second hour, Julie Nestingen is going to be joining us from the SEVA Foundation, which is an organization that has been doing service around the world for over 30 years. So she will bring us in to the conversation of service from that perspective. And Lynn will, of course, stay with us for the whole time. So I want to welcome Lynn at this time. Hello, Lynn.
Hi, Jamil. It's so fun to visit with you again.
It's such a pleasure for me, too. You know, I just find your work so incredibly valuable at this time. And I just feel like it's just time to really look at our power as co-creators for our reality and on all levels, you know, our multidimensional reality, the world going on inside of us, the world going on outside of us, in our little circles, in our big circles. This is our co-creation, every single bit of it. And I want to ask you, as I have off air, to please lead us in a very brief meditation intention to quiet the energy. I feel to acknowledge that we here in America have entered the electoral politics reality going on. And
yes, we have.
Indeed. And the only thing I really want to say, and you can say whatever you want about that, it's fully open, but what I really want to say about that is, in the conversation of consciousness, what I have found consistently in my lifetime is that the electoral politics is really almost like a gun going off and telling everybody to get on their horses and to go fight. You know, it starts this big energy of conflict, and my side is right, and my guy's the one, and oh, bam, 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 and they both pretty much say the same thing. You know, look at that guy and vote for me, and you know, that to me is an energy that is really distracting from the true power of who we really are. So I feel in specific to request this meditation. Please, Lynn, let's meditate and calm that. You know, let's calm that.
Yeah. I think that politics can be a great screen for a lot of our psychological shadow to emerge. Mm. And in fact, I'm actually going to be doing some work with that and the political environment in some of my Tuesday night webinars as we get closer to election. But we won't go into that now. But I think you're so right. There's so much up. So, okay, I'll do a little meditation right now just to set the mood for the next couple of hours. All right, everybody listening, just take a nice deep breath or two. And you'll notice that just taking a deep breath in and of itself changes things. You can feel your body relaxing. And you can also notice that as you give attention to your breath, it quiets your mind. And you just start to be more fully present. Present in your body. Present in this moment. And now imagine that you're leaving reality as you've known it behind. For the moment, you can pick it up again if you want to later or not. But imagine that we all have entered a space where anything is possible. And we create the space together just with our intention, with our consciousness. We make this moment that we're sharing with everybody else who's listening into a sacred space. And imagine that miracles are not just possible, but already beginning to unfold for each and every one of us who's part of this shared experience now. And you don't need to even believe this. Just imagine what it would feel like if you did. And as you imagine this, just let a feeling of excitement begin to well up, a sense of anticipation grow, a feeling that wonderful things are happening. You don't know what, but you know they're wonderful. And just hold the intention for everyone listening to these words right now in the moment, or perhaps in the future to a recording of this. All of us are now receiving miracles. And just take another deep breath and come on back into your body. And maybe we've shifted a little bit.
Thank you.
My pleasure. What a nice way to start.
Well, please continue and share with us your Making Miracles book, and perhaps just take it from where you just began your introduction and how the miracle making reality is not just for the few, but is actually the work in progress in the universe.
Sure. Well, you know, I've spent a couple of years now just traveling around, actually the world, not just the country, and sharing with people miracle experiments. And the miracle experiment, what I talk about is miracle experiments, are something that I first introduced through my book, Making Miracles. And it's kind of like a growing snowball of group consciousness, where the miracle experiment invites every participant to bypass all the presumed boundaries of space and time. And these boundaries, really, science is showing to be very permeable. To just bypass all that, to reach out in loving compassion to every other participant in this experiment, wherever they happen to be in space and even in time. And then the experiment involves focusing and directing all this collective energy of love to see what kind of miracles we can create for ourselves and for each other and for the world beyond. And so essentially this experiment is a means of gathering people, and in that gathering, building energy for miraculous manifestation. And as we operate outside of time and space, it enables many, many more people to be together in intention and in consciousness than could easily happen in linear time or in one place. And this creates a generator-like wave of consciousness, like a massively focused prayer that works on behalf of every participant. And you know, this sounds kind of crazy, but in my book I actually share some of the science behind this experiment, because if you put this experiment into the context of some of the really mind-boggling science demonstrating the virtually limitless power of consciousness to transcend time and space and to affect reality, it doesn't seem so outlandish anymore. And so I've been sharing this experiment for a couple of years now, and there are now thousands and thousands and thousands of people who've added consciousness and loving intention to build this prayer. And now I want to make it bigger. I want to make the miracle experiment bigger, because I've heard so many amazing stories from people that they really are seeing their lives change. Wonderful things show up, healings happen, just quality of life starts changing in all of these amazing ways. And what I want to do now is take it to another level. And this fall, really this month, I'm launching the Making Miracles Project. And this this project invites people to gather together in groups for miracle making. Because, you know, the miracle experiment is all about coming together in love for the good of all. And when we do this work in a way that we're coming together in consciousness, in this very global way of joining with everybody through intention, and we're also doing it in a FaceTime way of coming together with our personal communities, It just makes it that much more powerful and more effective. I'm just feeling that it's so important for us to gather with our personal communities these days. And so what I'm doing is that I'm offering a lot of support to help people gather. And this can be in a one-time event, which I'm actually calling a Making Miracles Party, or to keep meeting with a group in an ongoing way as a Making Miracles group as part of the ongoing project. Now, what I mean by a Making Miracles group is essentially a group that meets to do the inner work of miracle making, and maybe we'll do a little miracle experiment here before we're done. And there's already a lot of groups doing this, that are they're using my book and the study guide that goes along with it as a structure for coming together and building the consciousness that gives rise to miracles. So people start seeing all kinds of wonderful things happen in their lives. But the Making Miracles project that I'm launching this fall has an added dimension to it, because I'm asking any group that wants to be part of this project in an ongoing way to sponsor a service project that in some way serves the world beyond the group's members. And these service projects can be anything, anything the group decides upon. And interestingly, I've been hearing that a lot of groups that started out as study groups with my book have just spontaneously started adopting a service project as part of their group mission. So it's sort of a natural extension of this miracle-making work. And the service component to this project, it isn't just because it's a good thing to do. Meeting together with other people and adding service to the inner work of miracle-making really works in alignment with the spiritual truth that acting for the highest good of all is actually the most self-serving thing we can do. And we can actually have more for ourselves as we reach out in love to one another. The service actually makes our own personal miracle-making work more effective. So that's my hope, that this project will seed all kinds of ongoing groups of people who are doing the inner work of miracle-making and forming community with all the benefits of that, and there are so many, as well as extending it even beyond their own group to helping their community in some way. Now, for any people out there who are thinking that I just don't have an ongoing group, you don't even have to be part of an ongoing group to participate in this project. There's a way that everyone listening can be part of this. As my own service, I'm offering to meet personally with any group of four or more to lead for you and your friends an hour-long miracle-making event. And I'll do this using e-meeting technology, which means I can meet with just about anyone, anywhere. So in other words, you can just invite me into your living room with a few of your closest friends, or you could even ask your church or your metaphysical bookstore to host it. And these presentations, they'll be live, and you'll be able to speak to me directly. You'll be able to ask questions if you want. And it'll make for a really fun way to get together with your friends or your community. It'll make for a good party. I'll make it fun. Now, for those of you who are going, yikes, eek, technology, don't be afraid. The technology you need for this is really very simple. Pretty much any newer computer will work, one that has Skype capability, meaning it has a camera and a microphone, and, of course, you need access to the Internet. And if you're gathering a group that's too big to fit around a computer screen, you can just hook up your computer to a flat-screen TV or to a projector and screen and a sound system like a boombox. And these connections are really very easy to do, and we can give you tech support to help you figure it out if you don't know how. So don't be afraid of the technology. And now even if you just gather for one time in one of these Making Miracles parties, you invite a few friends over, and I'm there, and we lead a miracle event, there's still a way that I will invite you and your group to be of service. Because at the end of these events, I'm going to ask you to make an offering of any amount to the Save a Foundation. And now Julie will be on in the next hour and tell you more about SEVA, but SEVA is just the most amazing organization. It was founded by the well-known spiritual teacher Ram Dass, author of Be Here Now, and of Wavy Gravy, who's also very well-known. He's a well-known clown, and he's known for his positive activism over the years, along with a couple of World Health Organization doctors. And they were all spiritual seekers back in the 70s who were looking for a path of service as part of their spiritual mission. And they focused on providing the service of restoring vision for people in third world communities because of something that can be done incredibly quickly and incredibly inexpensively and makes a huge difference in the life of an individual, but even beyond that, in the life of a whole family and their ability to survive and thrive. So over several decades now, they've been doing this amazing, truly miracle-making work. And it's all done with such incredible love. So if my service project is that I am going to meet with as many groups as I possibly can, really support you, if you want, in continuing to be in community together and do miracle-making work, and at the end ask for a donation of any amount to the Save a Foundation that can help them continue their worldwide, phenomenal work. I'll share a little bit of the inspiration for this project. This project had its roots in my book launch last spring, because my publisher, Namaste Publishing, they are just amazing service-oriented people too, an incredible group. And as a way of launching my book, they combined it with a fundraising project for Save a Canada in Vancouver, which is a separate but related organization to the Save a Foundation in the U.S. They do similar work. And Constance Kello, the president of Namaste, partnered with the biggest bookstore in North America, Banyan Books, to donate all the profits from the sale of my book, Making Miracles, to Save a through the month of May. And I was so delighted with this being the way my book made its entry into the world, because really the core philosophy of Making Miracles, as well as my own 40-year career in ministry and service work, is that we can have more for ourselves as we reach out to help others. And I just really wanted to keep this wave of giving going, because, you know, I think service isn't just a selfless act anymore. I really think of it as the new self-help. And I can talk a little bit more about why I think coming together is so crucial these days. But I'll take a breath and give you a moment, Jamil.
That was really important. I'm really grateful you shared all of that information. And this is, you know, the crux of the whole thing is service. And service in the Making Miracles book is introduced in the way that all the exercises, this is my interpretation, are brought to us. And in the exercises are all some variation of a meditation, a self-reflection, because service begins, of course, with our own inner work, with becoming somehow aligned in our own clear channel of being part of the co-creation of the highest good. I will just say I would like to change the word miracles and just put the highest good. I'm going to do that for the rest of this conversation, because miracles has this charge. It's been, I don't like the charge on it. So I'm just going to call it the highest good. Because when we think about the highest good, it naturally puts us into the benefit of all. And that is what your book did for me in reading through the exercises, because in the very beginning of all of the exercises, we think about all of the readers, past, present, and future. And we bring all of them into our own personal process. And we have this great opportunity that I have really found value in connecting in our inner world to all of these people who on some level want to make their lives better, want to join to make the world a better place. This is why people pick up books with this title, Making Miracles, right? They want to make something better. Yeah. So this is the group we're talking to. We're talking to the people who really, really want to do their part. You know, and that book doesn't just give you your part in the reflections and the tools that you offer, but it gives us a whole community on a very intimate spiritual level in our inner world, in the psychic planes, in the astral planes, whatever you want to call them, because as your first lessons point out, in the science available, they call it zero point or whatever, 1,000 names. I like zero point, where we all meet. We are intimately connected, so everything we do affects everybody anyway. So, hey, why not get with the program and find out what we could do to make that the highest good manifestation? You know, I find it so obviously practical and so much more challenging to implement than, you know, the... You say, we all say, okay, just do it. But, you know, it is a lot of work. And in our own self, it's our own personal work that is required to raise this consciousness to a miracle-making level. So perhaps you can address that. You said that the consciousness gives rise to miracles. So what is this rise in our consciousness that you perceive has to happen to enter this dimension of miracle creation.
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's a way that even at the level of our inner work, the path of it becoming easier is to join with other people.
Mm.
You know, I mean, a lot of us have had the experience of meditating at home and we're distracted by everything. Then we get with a great big group of people meditating. It's like, whoosh, it's so easy. And, you know, I think that there's a change happening that, and I'm getting a little bit away from your question, but I'll get back to it. I'm providing a little background here. I think that there's a way that humanity not just is changing, but has changed, and not just in really subtle, energetic kinds of ways, but in some really obvious and dramatic ones, and in ways that have everything to do with humanity discovering its collective power. And there's just examples everywhere. And this is in the outer world, not just in our inner lives. We can see it in the way that governments have changed over, and grassroots political movements have risen all over the world as people find strength together. I think it was so interesting that Time magazine last year even named the protester as their person of the year, noting that almost all the protests this year began as independent things, you know, without encouragement from existing political parties, or, you know, meaning that it's all been from the ground up without any top-down instigation. And we're seeing that careers can be made now as people go directly to the masses, to YouTube, Facebook, crowdfunding sites, meeting, you know, masses of people one by one by one by one, whereas in the past there would be this necessary intermediary of some kind of established industry. And we're also seeing, you know, the hot new business model is that of resource sharing, like the Zipcar that's become incredibly successful, where people can drive a car without having to own one. You can see bikes everywhere, shared bikes. We're finding more and more ways to share rather than own. And a lot of what is facilitating this is technology, which really, at this point, I think, has evolved to a place where it's now starting to evolve us. And the internet is actually enabling the emergence of a sort of hive mind that's more intelligent than individual minds working alone. In fact, MIT has even started a whole center for, what's it called, Center for Collective Intelligence, that's all about studying this phenomenon of a human mind connected to a computer, connected to everybody else's computers and minds, and are looking at ways that this new form of intelligence might be harnessed for the common good. And I think it's so interesting that at this time, when world population is so huge and we're having more and more reason to feel invisible and anonymous and alienated, we now have this just incredibly personal technology that enables us to reach beyond this incredible, you know, gap of our distance and our numbers to touch individuals that we're never going to meet. You know, social media vehicles like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube are putting a very personal face to this vast abstraction of humanity. And I think that there's a way that our technology has really primed us for global caring. And I personally think it's even teaching us how to love in a whole new way, where we're able to reach beyond the tribe mentality of our local communities to break down the faceless masses of humanity into people, into real people, and to care. And I think that there's a way that we as a species just seem to be broadly assimilating and acting upon. You know, maybe this is the 100th monkey effect or just the inevitable result of the internet, a message that we can have more for ourselves as we band together and band together globally rather than locally. And I think for those of us who are committed to our personal growth and spiritual seeking, this can't help but change how we go about it, the shift. So I really foresee the emergence of a new metaphysics that takes technology out of the mix and replaces that high connectivity we have now via the internet with a connection through intention and pure consciousness alone. And this new metaphysics holds at its core the tenets that we're exponentially more powerful together than separately, that love is the most potent change agent there is, and it puts into practice what science is showing to be this virtually limitless power that consciousness has to change physical reality, transcend time, transcend space. So, you know, in the same way that people are gathering now in grassroots demonstrations around the world, we can do that through conscious intention alone. And this just opens vast new possibilities for tapping, you know, the power of mind over matter, which science has already proven to be really significant. And so I think it's going to really change our inner life and our inner work. And that this whole new metaphysics that I see starting to come into play, it really ends the whole duality of giving and receiving. You know, that old axiom of it's better to give than receive always lies in polarity, and that means it also is in relationship to the idea that there's not enough to go around, so, you know, I'd better grab mine first. You know, in this duality, even if we try to be good, we can either attend to our own needs or care for others, so being a good person always involves sacrifice, and it forces our energy to be divided between ourselves and others. Now, you know, for those of us who have worked with A Course in Miracles, this duality gets evolved into giving and receiving are the same. But that, you know, that's such a, I think, such a hard-to-grasp abstraction that I think that putting it into practical application where we really see through our own highest good unfolding more rapidly when we reach out to others, when we join with others in consciousness, when we reach out a hand to a neighbor, when we be of service down at the food shelf or, you know, whatever it is for us, when we reach out to other people with this different consciousness, we all gain. We all have more.
So the consciousness that we're reaching out with is both an accumulation of our collective intention grounded in love and the understanding that it's about we, the whole is what we're, the end game, if you will, the whole, the prosperity of all.
Yeah.
And
that there's something in this power of we. You know, I think in older paradigms, we consciousness we had a sense of loss to it. Like we lose some of our individuality. We lose some of our own personal good in joining with we. I think we're entering a whole new paradigm of collective power where we start going to the collective to as a power source, as a generator, as we do with this miracle experiment work, where joining together in love actually is the energy that fuels all of our heart's desires. Can I give a really quick little example of that?
Please.
This is how it works. This is something you can, all of you listening, can just do along with me. Just for a moment, bring to mind some highest heart's desire that you would like to bring into manifestation. You know, just like The Secret teaches us to do. You know, imagine it for a moment so you feel all warm and fuzzy inside. And then let it go. That's old metaphysics. Let it go. Now, here's where new metaphysics come in. Now, imagine yourself able to reach out beyond time and space to every other person who has, is, and will hear these words. You don't have to believe this is possible. Just imagine what it would feel like if you did. And imagine that we're all joining minds, bringing only our highest and best to the table, forming a pool of consciousness, a morphic field, to use a term coined by Rupert Sheldrake. Now, to activate this field of consciousness for just a moment, let yourself love all these unseen, unknown fellow listeners. And not for any reason, just simply because you can. Love them with all your heart, just as you would your nearest and dearest. And with the biggest wave of love that you can muster, send in your imagination the heartfelt wish that miracles now happen for each and every one of them. And you don't even need to believe that this is really doing anything. Just imagine how it would feel if you did believe that your loving intention is quietly making life better for people you'll never even know. And there. That's it. You've done it. And now people you'll never meet have just done the same for you. Just like a massively focused prayer offered on your behalf. And we know there's a lot of research showing the power of anonymous prayer. It really makes a difference. And you've just received it in a big way. And as you look at how you felt in that process, didn't it feel good to want the best for all of these unknown people and to imagine that perhaps that really could make a difference for people? And doesn't it also feel pretty good knowing that all of these people are also on board making miracles happen in your life? That's it. That little exercise is a miracle experiment. And as I put forth a lot of them in my book, Making Miracles, just to see what might happen. And I've gotten stories from readers as soon as the book went out, that they started seeing healings and manifestations and all kinds of wonderful things happen. But what I find even more significant is how many people have shared with me just feeling less alone and more loved and more compassionate, more connected. So this is what I see as the new metaphysics. And I think it has obvious benefits. We all come together, and each one of us receives more. But what I think can't be gauged is the broader effect this is having on the world. That as each of us join this pool of love, we change. And then we ripple that out to everyone who would never even think of doing a miracle experiment. But, you know, that could be bigger than we'll ever really know, for sure.
Well, let us live in that time where we realize that. let's see that love manifesting now, and kindness and concern openly expressed in the streets of our town. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
And I think we're seeing that same kind of energy sharing in so many ways. I mean, that's what crowdfunding sites are about. Like Indiegogo, for example, where there's all these great causes, and people just go and they send them energy, you know, with their dollars. I think that there's ways that we're going to learn to do that with consciousness. I think that at some point we'll realize that the Internet provided a sort of training wheels for us, learning how to connect in all kinds of ways for the benefit of all.
I totally agree with that, and I feel like the obvious step also is just happening, and the universe is a genius. It's really got a plan, and I found in my own development that letting the universe do its part is just so much easier. It's like, I don't have to take on all the things that I thought I had to take on, because the universe really is in motion, you know? It's really got things going along really well, and it has nothing but the promotion of the highest good for all. The nature of life itself is to expand and to glorify, beautify, enhance itself. Life is always seeking to create and express, and that's just, I think, the most basic physics in the universe, in my little way of looking at it. But that's what gives me peace, you know, and understanding that whatever my part is in the whole, doing it with this sincere intention of really bringing the best to all that whoever I might touch in, you know, my town or on the internet or whoever. That's all that really matters, because that is something we can do every day. And you were talking about the way that love is the next step of the metaphysical, the new metaphysics. And would you please share with us how you're defining love? Love is another word that we're ready to revisit and evolve with, I think. And can you share with us where love and consciousness, how they meet and how they work in this conversation of miracle making, of creating the highest good for all?
Sure. I that's a great question, because love truly is one of those overworked words. Who knows what it means after a while?
Mm-hmm.
and I think of love not as something soft and wimpy, but as the ultimate power source. And I think, I again like to go to science to just start to put some of this together. I think that, first off, there's just an incredible amount of research now coming from the medical community, decades of it, showing the healing power of love. There's a great book that came out, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago now, by Dean Ornish, who's an MD, and he just pulled together a lot of the scientific research documenting the connection between love, whether it's just physical touch or, you know, all kinds of love, and people's ability to heal. And
will you elaborate a little more? What are these types of love? So we have a broader perspective than
Everything from having a pet, you know, just something to stroke and to pet, to a nurse coming in and touching a person when taking blood pressure versus not, to support group love, to reaching out and helping other people love, to family love, to spirituality, love of God, you know, all love in just about any way, shape, or form you can imagine has a healing impact. The book is, if anybody wants to check it out, it's called Love and Survival. A really, really excellent read by Dean Ornish. So, you know, so we know that it has a healing power. And I think that some of what, some of the research that's been done on people who've had near-death experiences also gives a really interesting glimpse into love, and I think perhaps its connection to the zero-point field. You know, the zero-point field represents the energy that's just always there when everything else has been sucked out of a space, and scientists are now recognizing that there is this field of energy and light that just underpins the physical universe. We can't see it, we can't touch it with our physical senses, yet if we knew how to tap it, it would just meet our energy needs in an unlimited way.
Hmm.
Now, from the world of research on people who've had near-death experiences, in other words, they've died clinically, come back into their bodies, and were able to tell of their experiences, they tell a very common story of their consciousness leaving their body, at which point you would imagine it would make sense that their consciousness would no longer be limited by the physical restrictions of being in a body, and they have an experience of going into the light, which would seem like they have an experience, a sensory experience, of the zero-point field. And what they say about that light is that it is synonymous with unconditional love, that it is intelligent, it is benevolent, it's not something cold or neutral, that light is love. They are one and the same. Now, you know, I think we're starting to get this picture of a living, benevolent, intelligent energy field that's just ever-present. It's around us all the time. We can't necessarily see it or touch it or know it's there, except through these outer realms, you know, of consciousness and science and research. But it is the essence of love.
Mm.
And I believe that field, just as scientists are saying, can meet all of our energy needs in an unlimited way if we build the right machine. I think that's the field that we tap when we do our law of attraction work. I think, you know, the whole science of mind over matter, the whole new thought spiritual teachings of mind over matter is all about tapping into this limitless field of light and love. And of course, I think the most accessible route, you know, sort of an obvious route, is through the path of unconditional love. When we go into that place of consciousness that is just being expansive and in the moment and in love, then we're tapping the field. And, you know, I think love is anything that just brings us fully present in that expansive state of, ah, you know, whether it's that first bite of our favorite ice cream or, you know, our favorite piece of music, or our connection to our beloved or of God, you know, it changes from love to something else. When that first bite of ice cream, you know, is more the addictive, you know, scraping the bottom of the pint, you know, that we haven't even tasted, that we're just trying to fill the void, it's also... it also shifts when we go from, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to have my heart's desire, into, oh, no, what if I don't get it? You know, that takes us from love and expansiveness into fearful attachment.
Mm.
So I think love has a lot of different manifestations. And, you know, it can also shift into fear. When we're locked into our own individual place of separateness, when we go back into that place, you know, a lot of manifesting techniques fail because it starts with that expansive love energy of, ah, isn't my heart's desire so wonderful? I really love it. I'm just in it. I can feel it. We go from there into fearful attachment of, oh, no, I won't get it.
Mm.
And if we can shift from, ah, wouldn't it be wonderful to have my heart's desire, to then, and, oh, I'm so excited for you. Let me just get excited about your heart's desire now. We stay in a place of love, and we create this fueling of one another, this empowering of one another, that really adds to the process and makes it that much more powerful. And we don't have the chance to go into our own place of fear that often follows love. So that's what I think of as the new metaphysics.
You put that very well, and I think that's a very accessible way of putting it. That is something we could really look at. I really liked your definition, your exploration of the ice cream. You know, oh yum, that feeling of gratitude of oh this is the best. To in opposition to the way that if we're an addictive eater, we have to have it. You know, we're filling an empty void. And I think that was a really, really good example. And the unconditional love and the part of bringing in our whole world to share in the bounty, you know, is what actually anchors it and allows it to grow. And the idea that getting mine for me is the actually in a way it cuts us everybody else winning as well if we're only focused on me, mine, getting what I need, you know, then in our psyches, in our own minds, we're cutting ourselves off from the experience and the joy of another person's triumph. Like when, say, we're watching the Olympics or we're watching, you know, our favorite little kid play softball or something, you know, don't we get excited when they hit the ball, you know? We're so excited because they're hitting the ball, you know? That's that's joy, that's love going into the universe, you know, to celebrate another person's victory, another person's accomplishment, you know? I think in a way what you said, when we contract and become fearful and the fearful attachment of losing, that I think we learn that as we get a little older, and that is something we can unlearn now.
Yeah. And I think it is so deeply rooted in our psyches to think of ourselves as separate, mm-hmm. and to think that I can either, you know, take care of myself or take care of you. And this is the shift that I don't think is just coming. I think it's starting to find us in a very big way all of a sudden. And, you know, maybe it is that 100th monkey effect that we've been talking about for so long, where we're all just getting it at once. Where, I mean, you know, that's why things like political grassroots grassroots movements just starting up without it being from a political top-down kind of instigation, why these things are just sprouting right now, that we're just getting it all at once, that when we come together, we have power. And I think this is something very new. I think it's because the Internet is so new. It's really taking us to a whole new level. And like I said, I think the Internet is just training wheels. I think that we're starting to get something in a really heartfelt way. You know, there was an interesting example of, there was a viral video that came out this year called Kony 2012, and it was a documentary about atrocities happening in Uganda with the warlord Kony, and tens of millions of people viewed that video, and there was even a little stir among some of the traditional media outlets where they were getting accused of, well, why didn't you cover this story? And the truth is they all did. They did cover it, but traditional media could not get people to care. It took this much more personal vehicle of YouTube that reaches people one by one by one by one. It's shared from one person to the next to get people to pay attention in the tens of millions and to really feel something in a heartfelt way. I think that's the whole difference in how we're doing things now. Mm. It's not through the established channels where it's from the top down. It's that we're all joining together and sharing things And that's how we're making things happen.
I see that too, and I feel like I'm watching humanity push up like in early spring, and in the first shoots, you know, in early spring, pushing through the soil, and because it's so new, we don't really know how to do it yet. You know, we don't really know how to love each other. We don't really know how to create space for each other because we really haven't practiced. This hasn't been our normal thing. And I believe it is our normal thing on the much higher levels, in our highest good, in the universe connection, what the NDEs have shown us. We are all one, that our interconnection with all that is, in what I call soul, with our higher being, is who we really are. And that is what I feel also is the essence of what's awakening. It's such a fantastic time to be alive. I'm very excited to see how are we going to figure this out. I'm really interested in how we are going to learn this. And I know we will. And I, you know that it will be unique to the individual, because as you pointed out, it is an individual journey. And, you know, the YouTube versus the mainstream media has a whole lot of other things to it. And perhaps one of the pluses is that, you know, in the mainstream media, we all have to admit they lied to us a lot. And there has been a huge upswell of people really getting tired of it. I'm a professional eavesdropper. I have heard some of the most people you would never expect to be speaking out against anything rant about the crap they put on TV and the garbage they put on the news. And on, I mean, I have been really moved and inspired that the truth seeking, the pushing for truth in the common consciousness has been exploding. And this is really, I think, part of why a YouTube feels safer. Right? We think that that is an independent thing. We think that is, you know, a more trustable source, because we're so tired of being lied to that if we can go to something and feel like we are taking our own sovereign power and choosing to watch it, then we feel more empowered in what we see. I think that there's a whole conversation in the consciousness that is a very important part, a huge, huge part in how we're going to push through this initial crust of dirt and this crust of where we've been. But I don't think this is really the place to get into that, because we have the good news of Julie having just joined us.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so would you like to, I don't want to just like cut us off right there, but I wanted to bring us into our focus with Julie and bringing her in. And would you perhaps like to introduce her and the SEVA organization and your relationship with her?
Yes, well, Julie is one of the wonderful staff that makes up the SEVA Foundation in the United States. They're based in Berkeley. And I said a little bit about SEVA before. They do just this amazing international healthcare work that just, it is very miracle making, and I'll let Julie talk more about that. But I have met Julie because I've been talking to the whole staff about how I can support their organization and their work with doing some fundraising, which I talked about a bit earlier with the Making Miracles project. And I'll leave it at that. I'll let Julie say some more about SEVA.
All right. Welcome, Julie.
Well, thank you. I'm really excited to be here with you guys. You know, SEVA, we're extremely grateful to have been reached out to by Lynn and involved in her project. It really resonates so deeply with the origins of SEVA, and we're an organization, as Lynn said, that we do international public health work. We work with preventable blindness in the developing world, and we also work with Native Americans on a domestic project around health and wellness. The organization itself is 34 years old, almost 35 years old, and it began in 1978 with sort of the spirit of service as a defining practice for our work and partnerships. The goal of the founding members was really to be of service, to help others help themselves. And the founding members were an eclectic group of people who were brought together by Dr. Larry Brilliant, who had just finished working in India on the eradication of smallpox, and he was working under Dr. Nicole Grasset. She was going on to work with the Nepal Blindness Project, and so Larry and his wife, Girija Brilliant, brought together a group of their friends who were very eclectic. They, you know, ranged from being medical people to educators to counterculture people to musicians and clowns. Some of the founding members were people like Ram Dass and Wavy Gravy and his wife, Johanna Romney. Anyways, they came together and they formed SEVA Foundation in 1978 with the idea to support Nicole Grasset's blindness work in Nepal. And from there it has grown. Blindness, preventable blindness is what we focus on, and it is 80% of blindness in the world is preventable. And that means of the 39 million people who live with blindness, 80% could see tomorrow if they had access to health, to eye care. And 90% of this occurs in the developing world where there is very little resources available to the people. And so that's where SEVA's work really focuses on serving the underserved communities. Two-thirds of the people who are blind in the world are women, and women and children tend to not have the same access to these resources as men do. So SEVA likes to put an extra focus on reaching women and children also. The other part of our work is with Native Americans, and that work started 30 years ago with SEVA being one of the original supporters of the Porcupine Clinic in Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And we helped fund that clinic, and it was the first Native-run clinic in all of the United States. And our program has sort of evolved, where today we are supporting communities that are trying to rebuild traditional food practices and restore health and wellness in the Native communities. So basically, the bottom line of both of our projects is to work with poverty, because both blindness and health disparities in the Native communities are really rooted in poverty. And so that is where SEVA starts out, by providing financial resources and technical expertise to help these communities help themselves.
Definitely a very much needed and valued services. And I think it's interesting, you've picked two in 30 years, and you've been focused in these two areas. And can you tell me a little bit about how big is your organization? And on your website, I was noticing there was some information. There's a lot of information about different ways that you can donate money. But I'm wondering also, is there ways that people can become trained on the ground? Say some people want to become in service to helping the indigenous communities of this country, or say they want to travel to be advocates for the site, you know, projects. And are there also ways that the SEVA organization facilitates on the ground people who are ready to actually go to work and put their gloves on?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think right now for SEVA, the best way people can actually be advocates and help is really through helping to raise funds for SEVA and raise awareness for SEVA, just like Lynn is doing. Our programs really pride themselves on building self-sustaining programs, so that we are training health practitioners in the countries where we're working, so that they will carry on without SEVA.
Okay.
And where we used to bring ophthalmologists in to go to these countries and do remote eye camps, where they would then provide services to people who hadn't had eye care, primarily we work now in training, and in advanced training of these professionals. And we, you know, through the training projects, we not only train ophthalmologists, but we also train community health workers, so that in vision centers that we set up in some of the more remote areas in say, Nepal or Cambodia, Tibet, where any of the 11 countries where we work, we are providing economic opportunities through employment for these people. So we don't use volunteers so much in the field unless they really have the medical expertise or if it's a technical expertise that they may bring in. And in, with Native communities, we are also funding projects that are really begun within their own communities, and it's about their gaining the skills and resources to carry on their projects and programs. So I think where people can be of most service is really in helping to bring awareness of SEVA's work and maybe doing their own projects that will help fund. I think, you know, that having sort of the idea of a service group helps where people can come together to generate funds. It can be through any kind of, I mean, the old days of SEVA, there were lots of service groups throughout the country that Ram Dass actually helped to get going. And they would come together in community to work on a service project that wasn't necessarily, they came together to do service and then also to help support SEVA. So some of the projects they worked on were unrelated to SEVA, but they came in through the need to be of service together. So, you know, I think today there are ways that people can help build resources for SEVA, but our work is not so much bringing people to the field to do work.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. And I do I understand that, you know, helping people help themselves is a very different approach than some of the more traditional models of, you know, the missionaries, right? They're going to go and save them and fix them and, you know, tell them how to do their business. Whereas if you're providing resources and helping people get back on their feet and find their own best way, that is a very different calculation or formula. That's the word I'm looking
Correct.
For.
Correct, yeah.
So, yeah, I can really understand that. And SEVA, I met SEVA 30 years or 27 years ago for the first time here in Boston at an event. So it was kind of fun to see it come around again. Of all the organizations that could come around, so I thought it was kind of cool. I was like, oh, that's interesting, you know, because SEVA itself is a Sanskrit word, is it not? It means something about service.
It means selfless service, yes. Selfless. It is a Sanskrit word meaning selfless service.
Okay. And I wonder if you and Lynn, too, because one of the things that I was looking at in my research and preparing for this interview is how we define service and in the consciousness, you know, that the conversation of consciousness, how we look at being of service. And service has so many different connotations and things like community service and the connection to community service being punitive as well in some places or a mandatory, and you know how these sorts of service memes in our consciousness really are only part of the service in that it does provide some assistance potentially, but it misses the love piece or it misses that conscious intention of what the Miracle Project, what we were just talking about. So I wonder if you guys would chime in about what you, how you define, how you've worked with the consciousness and some of the old memes that are floating around out there and what we actually relate to, what we regard as service, you know? Is it just picking up trash or what is it, you know?
Do you want to field that first, Julie, or shall I?
I'll let you go. Start out, and I'll follow.
Okay. You know, I think that some of what I've been talking about over the last hour is that I think human consciousness really is undergoing a shift. That old paradigm says that whole is better to give than receive axiom that creates this duality between you and me. And my highest good and your highest good. So if I am reaching out to do service, it's kind of sacrificial. And where I think we are now is in a whole different paradigm where there really is a, I mean, I think of service as the new self-help, that there's something about reaching out to other people that takes us all higher. And it's important to differentiate the actions of service from the inner experience of love. I think ultimately that is the highest service when we feel love.
And to find our own path of service, you know, it doesn't have to feel like climbing Mount Everest. It doesn't have to feel like we have to get on a plane and go to Nepal and, you know, live in a third world country and, you know, reach out in that way. I mean, I know that there are some service opportunities that do give that kind of experience, like Habitat for Humanity is one of those, where you can just travel all over the world and do good things. But I think that service can be such an easy thing. It can be as easy as reaching out to a neighbor in a loving way, where you would maybe normally just mind your own business. I think that the highest service starts with listening to where our heart is guided to give. And as I said, that can be as simple as reaching out to a neighbor, or it could mean following your passion to some remote corner of the world to build a house for people who really need it. I think when we listen to where our love is, that actually is going to take us in the direction of our highest service. You know, and there are those times where we have to just recognize that our highest service is to ourselves at times. That, you know, if we're the kind of person who gives and gives and gives, at least does all the activity of giving until there's nothing left for ourselves, then we're out of balance and we have to put ourselves first and take care of ourselves as our highest path of service. Yet, when we're living from love, we love ourselves, we love other people, there isn't really a difference, we just listen to where our love is guiding us. And, you know, I think that's why so many of the groups who've been already working with some of this miracle-making material that starts out being just, you know, reach out to each other and to all the miracle experiment participants, send them love, these groups have just naturally, without any instigation from me, started to adopt service projects outside of their own members. I think when we listen to love, that's just where it takes us.
Thank you.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, as I was mentioning in the early origins of SEVA, that service aspect beyond the work SEVA was doing internationally was also within the membership of the founding members. And what I found interesting, I was reading through some of our old historic documents, and really their philosophy was that to do good in the world and to grow and be enriched personally in the process was a SEVA intention, and so that it was a spiritual quest.
Yeah, and it took them somewhere that
need
that
to
was
reach
better
out and make a difference in somebody else's life. But it's very much rooted, I think, in sort of the individual drive with an outer an outreach to benefit others. Maybe some of us, it's, you know, many of us probably are just, we're all driven in different ways, and I think probably the people that you find certainly involved with SEVA have a burning desire to be of service, to make a difference in the lives, you know, of other people. That's just maybe the way that we think and are wired, and that's not for everybody. I think in the work Lynn does, it's just that, you know, it is that outward extension of who we are. It can be, as you said, Lynn, it can be in your own neighborhood. I mean, one of the most rewarding experiences I went through is when I moved to California about 18 years ago, I had a neighbor who was, for about 5 years, from age 89 to 94, I took her to the bank every month because she used to take the bus, two buses, to go to two banks and withdraw money and put it in another bank, and it just seemed like such a risky thing for an elderly woman to do that I wanted to help out. But really interesting thing in my service was I got so much from being with her. So it rewarded me so much to be in her presence and to learn from her and learn from her wisdom that she had gained through the years of living. So maybe my being of service was really of service to me as well.
Mm.
Yeah, I can relate to that, too. I know my very first volunteer service, was when I was 10, and I volunteered for a neighborhood hospice where I would just go every week and I would feed people who were dying and couldn't feed themselves. And, you know, my parents were horrified. Every week they just felt that they had to debrief me and that this was just too traumatic for a little kid. And I kept having to explain to them that, how much love I felt for these people. And it was hard for me because I was a little 10-year-old. It was hard to find the vocabulary.
Wow.
But I remember that being such an amazing experience of my heart just being filled to overflowing. I mean, I would have just stayed there all week long if I could.
Mm.
And I think that that's what it's about, having that experience of so much love that it stops being about giving. It just becomes this joining in love where everybody is going to a higher place.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. That's...
You know, and it's interesting, the SEVA founders, many of them, had been together on a bus ride that took them through. Basically, they were headed toward... Well, they went through Afghanistan and Pakistan. They ended up in Nepal. They're Larry Brilliant and Girja Brilliant and Wavy Gravy and Johanna. They came back so moved by the generosity that the people they met through these countries had shown them. Everywhere they would stop, people would surround their bus and offer them food, offer them whatever they needed. And they came back so overwhelmed. They really had this burning desire to give back. You know, so it was like that whole act of kindness and generosity triggered in them the need to do something back. And I think that's sort of the beautiful thing, too, that can come out of this is that ongoing spillover effect and how it can stimulate others to do the same thing. And I think that sense of gratitude carries is a wonderful kind of fuel for motivating people to continue on. And one of the earlier parts of our program is they had a program where they trained people who had received cataract surgery to become spokespeople in their community so that they would go out and talk to others so they wouldn't be afraid to go in and have surgery. So, we're talking very remote areas in Nepal and India and at the time where the people would come back and they were probably the greatest spokespeople for encouraging other people to have, not to be afraid to go in and have the surgery. And, there weren't radio communications or cell phones in those days, so people really had to kind of go out and be that advocate. And the gratitude when you see somebody see for the first time after having been maybe blinded for 1 year or 5 years, it could be, however long their cataract has been there, is just incredible. Their whole life has changed. And so, I think that kind of energy can flow easily between people.
And just one little aside, it only takes $50. A $50 donation is all it takes to enable someone to see, and that includes everything.
Not only that, Lynn, it's 15 minute surgery on average. It's a little different for this is for adults. For children, we use anesthesia because they're younger, they move a lot. But when an adult has a cataract surgery, they just they operate on the eye, and in 15 minutes they remove that clouded lens and replace it with an artificial, it's called an interocular lens, and that person can now see. And it's what's remarkable in that is that their entire life has changed, and the person has now the opportunity to return to being a contributing member of
their community because they've been released from being somebody left at home because they can't see, they can't go to school, or they can't work. They become, in their mind, an extra burden to their family. Often somebody has to stay at home with the person and care for them. So now another family or two family members are now also able to go on with their life once the surgery happens and they can see again. So it really, it benefits not just the individual, it spills over, it benefits the family, and it benefits the community.
Mm. And this can just extend into generations when a child is allowed to go back to school and
absolutely
be employed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm. And that's, that whole, you know, the entire life of that child then has been restored to to be changed forever. Having access to an education, now they will be able to go on and work in the world. And also for adults, they found in India that 90% of the people who had cataract blindness and had stopped working, 70% of those people could return to work after surgery within 1 week. And they found that patients could earn 15 times more the cost of surgery after treatment from 1 year. So it's like so cost effective. And as a matter of fact, cataract surgery is really among the most cost effective health interventions because it will change so much about that, what that individual is able to do.
Mm. Well, here's what I want to ask of everybody listening to this. This is so win-win. Help me get this Making Miracles project started. What I'm hoping is that every single person listening today will invite three or more of your friends to gather together and host a Making Miracles party. I will just come to your living room through e-technology, you know, e-meeting technology, and I'll lead a Making Miracles presentation. It'll be really fun. So you'll all share a miracle experience. And you'll be able to talk to me. You can ask questions. If you want, you can even be on the camera when you ask a question so that everybody will see you. And at the end, I'll just ask for a donation of any amount that will go to SEVA. And if everybody out there will help me with this, this will just turn into a big global miracle party. I'm going to start this on Sunday, September 23rd. I'm going to meet with as many groups as I can all day on Sunday. I'm going to do a marathon. Mm-hmm. And with e-meetings, I can meet with more than one group at a time. So I'm going to make a huge party out of this. If you'll help me, this can start a huge wave. There'll be people from all over the world. At the end, you'll pass the hat, take a donation. You'll send it directly to SEVA through an Indiegogo page that we've set up. And there's not even any suggested donation for this. I'm doing this very unconditionally. This is my service. So if four of you get together and give $500, thank you. If 50 of you get together and give $1, thank you. You know, everything is fine. Just join in. Join in, because this is about starting a wave of consciousness and of service. Some of it is about connecting the inner work of miracle making with the outer work of service. Sometimes, you know, especially those of us who lean toward metaphysical communities, we get so caught up with the inner work that we never make that transition to also doing the reaching out to the community beyond ourselves. And sometimes the churches that are really great at doing all the community service don't make that connection to this inner work of miracle making. So please share this with me. Please help us, like we're saying, you know, a $50 donation. If you got a bunch of friends together you gave $50, you had a wonderful party, and you could change the life of a whole family. You know, how win-win is that? What can you possibly lose? You can register for a presentation on my website. Just go to lynnwoodland.com, and you'll see it. Just find it. If you can't find it, email me from my website. We'll, you know, make sure you get it all figured out. If you need help with any of the technology, we'll help you with that, too, to figure out how to do it. It's really very simple what you need on your end. And, you know, if any of you are affiliated with a nonprofit organization, a 501c3 organization like your church, for example, that might want to sponsor a miracle-making party with me, we're open to sharing the offering between SEVA and your organization, so it can even be a fundraising event for your organization as well as for SEVA. And, you know, you might have such a good time that your group will be inspired to keep going, to keep doing miracle-making work together, and to find some kind of service project that will just leave you feeling incredibly good, that it will be so win-win. So please take the next step. If you're enjoying this conversation at all, please take the next step and get involved.
And clarify, please, what these four people that are required, do they need to have a service project in mind to plant the seeds and carry on? Do they need to have any connection to your book or awareness of your philosophy? Or what is the requisite?
Everybody out there can do this, because you can just treat it as a one-time party.
Okay.
As a fun way to just get together with a few friends and have a little miracle experience. And you know, do a good turn for the world by sending a few bucks in the direction of SEVA. So, you know, there's no, you know, nobody's going to be selling you anything or pushing anything or pressuring you. There's absolutely no pressure around this. Because I really believe that all things come through unconditional giving rather than through selling. There's nothing I need to sell to anyone. I'm doing this project purely as my gift, because I know that service is fun, it's catching, and, you know, and it's self-serving. Service is something that lifts us all, including the giver with it.
Okay, well, I want to clarify, because what I read on your website is that you're challenging that the service projects can be, it does state here, in addition to the self-help function, each Making Miracles group is asked to have as part of its mission a service project that will in some way serve the world beyond its own members. So to clarify that you're not really asking for that, you're just actually offering Making Miracles parties as an opportunity to meet the miracle work and make an available opportunity to donate to the SEVA Foundation. I want to clarify, because I have I've done a good amount of promotion on this, and I really want to be really clear about what you're talking about now.
Yeah, I differentiate between just hosting a Making Miracles party, which you can do once, and really you are doing some service if you give a donation to SEVA. That is your service. For any group that's inspired to keep going, that's what I think of as the Making Miracles group. And those would be groups who would continue to meet in an ongoing way to do the inner work of miracle making and also to do the outer work of service. And I'll offer all the help I can to help you structure those meetings and make it fun and keep it going. And But you would be the ones who would decide what your service project is. And I'll even offer a default service project, which would, you know, essentially be just taking an offering at the end of every session and giving it to SEVA. Easy.
Okay, so what you're saying is that if we want, we can just get a group together to have service in whatever donation we want to offer to SEVA, and that's the Miracles Party.
And then
the Making Miracles project is for people who have already formed a group that are really committed to working in the community, and then you'll be available to assist them in gathering the focus and the intention and moving it into their communities.
Well, I'm sorry this is sounding so confusing. You know, my intention, this whole project is to bring groups together. I don't care if you just meet once. In a Making Miracles party, just have me come do a presentation. It'll be fun. You'll make a donation. It's all win-win. Now, you might get together with your friends and think, wow, this is so fun, we want to do it again. And you might then be inspired to continue as a Making Miracles group. And you might meet every week, you might meet every couple of weeks. I'll give you all the support I can to do that. You'll take on some service as well as the inner work of miracle making. So, you know, it all can start with just hosting a party. There's no pressure. You don't have to keep going, and you might want to. I'm just betting that a lot of groups that start this are going to want to continue. I don't need to pressure anyone. Like I said, this is about giving, not selling. It's just how it is. When you do this once, many people are going to want to do it again. Is that clear now?
Well, it's clearer. So then what I hear you're saying is that the idea being to come together and share in this process is perhaps a vehicle that we might begin to discover what our deeper heart's calling is to service, and having an environment that is a safe environment to begin to explore some of those deeper feelings and our deeper connections to ourselves and each other in the group, that this might be a vehicle to cultivate that. I think that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, groups that want to keep meeting to do miracle making, and part of your mission would also be to talk about, wow, what could we do to serve the greater community? You might decide to sponsor a family in need in your community. You might decide to... I know a group that they just do this wonderful service. They sing to people who are dying. I mean, what a wonderful thing is that? I mean, service can take so many different forms. It may be that you're a healer, and or you're a group of healers, and you decide to take your healing hands to the local nursing home every so often. You know, there's so many different ways people can be of service, and that part is up to you. The urging on my part is just to, as you do the inner work, also take that next step. Find some kind of compassionate service that would just feel joyful to do.
Okay. And perhaps you can share now, and Julia as well. We haven't heard Julie chime in about the growing consciousness, but I bet she has something to offer on that level, because I'm curious how, in Seva, have you noticed an expansion of people's interest in your work of late?
We're pretty much focused on really getting the work out to the projects and the programs. Where we would notice more of a consciousness would be sort of in reaching people through our communications, and certainly through, I think, using the social media and the internet, we've reached a lot more people than we did in the old days when we, you know, would have just, you know, mail contact or concert contact. And I mean, I think going way back to the origins when we had service groups across the country, but really those haven't been very active since the 90s. So then I think right now the internet has sort of changed a lot of our ability to reach people. And certainly we reach people also through Seva has a very strong musical community where we have wonderful performers who, since we began, starting out with the Grateful Dead, doing concerts to benefit Seva. We have wonderful musicians like Bonnie Raitt and Jackson Brown, Crosby, and, you know, just who come and perform for us year after year after year, Steve Earle.
and they donate their time. And so we have musical venues where we reach out to people in a community. And we have people who come through us through the continuing Ram Dass connection. So I think we have a very eclectic base of people that we reach in many different ways. And some people come in through their interest in either health care or their connection to blindness or their connection to Native communities or to diabetes. So I think our outreach comes in through many different ways for people.
Okay. Well, I was just curious if you'd seen an increase in, like, the donations or anything that would give you indication that people are thinking more about helping out in another way, you know, any surge at all in the last year or something. I'm just curious.
No, I'd say we were hit like other organizations in 2008 by the economic downturn, and definitely since that time we've seen an increase in people supporting us. Everybody tightened up. We know we have a wonderful gifts of service catalog, which is an alternative gift giving, and that's one way that we really connect to people where you can give a service. Give the gift of eyesight, supply a Native American family with seeds for a garden to grow their own foods through that catalog. And that gift is, you know, can be used to give to somebody, a loved one, for, you know, a birthday or an anniversary or a holiday gift. And you both give that, we call it the gift of service, and you provide a service by honoring somebody in your life. And then, you know, that's been a really strong part of SAVA's support from individual donors, and I wouldn't say we've been seeing an increase, like a surge in that. I think our donors have been pretty steady for us, yeah.
Hmm. Will you share with us a little bit about your work here in the States with the Native American community?
Sure. Well, the Native American program started primarily through we worked with developing something called Talking Circles, and it was our work around diabetes, which is very diabetes type 2 in Native American communities. And Talking Circles was a training curriculum to work with Native leaders who could then take that into the community and, you know, work with other trainers to talk to Native people about caring for themselves in the either maintaining or prevention of type 2 diabetes. That has changed a little in the last 5 years. Our focus is now really working to support community-based groups in Native communities to revitalize more traditional food practices and connect them more with traditional bringing back food. So we support projects that build community gardens, so people can grow more of the traditional foods that they used to eat when they had healthier lifestyles. I mean, I think a lot of Native communities don't have access to good grocery stores, especially in rural areas or reservations, and being able to grow their own food. We have supported a project in Alaska where we helped reconnect older trading routes along a river north of the Arctic Circle. We are supporting a project in South Dakota right now also, which has helped build Native or community gardens, and also we're looking at helping to bring funding into a Native grocery store, Native-run grocery store. So our work really is Native people come, you know, groups will come to SAVA. If we support them through a lot of the groups that we used to fund through small grants, we have already built a relationship with. So we contacted right in the beginning, we contacted three groups that we continue to support in their projects, and we'd already worked with them in the past. So we're looking to expand these small groups that we work with. And it's just a slow process identifying groups that are already started who need support maybe for 3 to 5 years to get to a level where they can continue on their own. So that's what we want to do, is build programs that have already begun and help them get to the next level through bringing in technical expertise or financial resources.
And how many people are on staff with SEVA? What is the, when you say we,
well,
is there specific?
Our Berkeley office, we have about 16, 17 people, a couple of people who are part-time.
Mm-hmm.
We have offices of people in Nepal has an office for the SITE program, Tibet has an office, and Cambodia has an office. So the rest of the projects that we support, we work through partnerships in the other 8 countries. So our offices are really based in Tibet, Cambodia, Nepal, and here in the U.S.
Okay, that's interesting. And then the outreach, that's a whole part of, that's a very modest staff. That's a lot of work you guys do.
Oh, but it's, we have partners throughout. So in the 11 countries where we work in the, say, the SITE program, I mean, we have partners. So that's a lot of what SEVA's work is built around really is on partnership. That's how we can operate as a small staff. It's working together. So it's really that outreach of working together to build stronger programs. And
what is a partnership program?
I'm sorry?
Will you share with us what is a partnership program with SEVA? What does that look like?
Well, we work, so we work with other... Our partners in the eye care program, we work with other institutions working in let's say, where we're working to develop more eye care programs that are build stronger eye care programs. So it's like a consortium. We have something called the Center for Innovation in Eye Care, and we work with 8 mentor institutions, and there's a standard of eye, you know, eye care systems of bringing the technical services and helping organizations, other smaller eye care organizations, run more efficiently and bring better services and do more outreach. So these 8 mentor institutions are working right now with 35 mentee small eye hospitals to develop stronger standards of operation where they can do more services and do more outreach. So in that partnership, we are working with organizations around the world that we have partners in. And when I say they're partners, they're people who also work in eye care. And so it's a network. It's a larger network working together to develop these systems where we can train and deliver services, you know, help smaller organizations develop the services. Some of our partners, like in India, Aravind was one of our first projects that we helped to support. Now they are a leading international eye training institute. And so we went from helping to fund their work to now being a partner with them where we work together. So maybe we're bringing eye care services to different parts of India and we can all add to the support of those projects. It's not just one SEVA project. So I don't know if that helps you understand what a partner is. It's like we aren't only, just not SEVA working alone in a vacuum. We're working with other organizations all working to expand the outreach of eye care in these countries.
Mm. Thank you. Yeah, that does help a lot because it's the whole idea of wanting to give support, it really helps to understand, you know, well, wow, when I'm going to give $50, I'm not just giving $50 for somebody to get eye care. I'm promoting a whole network that's all, that the whole intention is to make this normal, you know, that that everybody gets this care because they deserve it, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than an individual thing.
SEVA alone,
you know,
doesn't do all of this work. Last year, through SEVA and our partners, over 700,000 people received eye care services, and 67,000 people last year received sight-restoring surgeries. That wasn't just done through SEVA. It was done through SEVA and other organizations that we partner and work with. So we may... Several of us may be supporting projects in different areas of Nepal or different areas of India, you know, to make that possible. So it really is. It's a much greater effort by many people to bring these services about.
That's great. That's great. I really appreciate you explaining that, because I think it really does make a difference in our consciousness, you know, how we feel and think about that, because we have a lot of choices, and we do have a lot of, you know, economic challenges. We're, you know, living in very volatile times, and, you know, in the essence of really wanting to be proactive and do the best we can, I think that's really invaluable information to know that we're supporting a whole, you know. I think that's connecting to what we've been talking about all day, you know, that whole interest in connecting to the bigger picture, to knowing that what we're doing is making a difference for everybody. So I think that was really important that you just shared that. So thank you very much.
Absolutely, and, sure.
Yeah, and so we are just 10 minutes and wrapping it up, and I want to bring you back, Lynn, and also just to offer any appropriate apology, though not apology, like, oh, I'm so sorry, but just that I needed that clarification. So I really am grateful that you rode with me on that while we clarified that. I just want to thank you is actually what I want to do for riding with me on that one, the clarification that I needed. And I want to bring us all back together now in our final comments. We've got 10 minutes, and I wonder if either of you would like to begin. And, you know, addressing our time of change and our time of evolving consciousness, our time of great opportunity. I mean, everywhere we look, there's a possibility to be of service. Even just smiling, you know, at somebody heading toward you on the street can make somebody's day, you know. And I really appreciate what you've both shared, you know, that really does make a difference. So, you know, we want to get together and become part of a Miracles group project, become part of a Miracles party, and develop that connection that we have and build it, because it really is a muscle we have to practice. You know, we have to build this way of doing it. So I really appreciate both of your work so much in being available to help us with this, because we really are all in this together, you know. So. Mm-hmm. Very exciting time, you know. So please offer, you know, whatever you'd like to in closing, and how you see perhaps your vision of how we're making this next step, and what you would like to see. You know,
I would like to do that. You know, I think we are living in such stressful times. As Julie said, nonprofits are being fairly hard hit because we all are just so tight with our money. And I think that there, you know, there are ways that we're feeling more alone and stressed and under pressure, and even the whole thought of service when we're locked into that place of survival can feel like, oh my gosh, I just don't have the energy for that. I can barely take care of myself. And the message that I'm hoping people will get from this last couple of hours is that life becomes easier as we come together and do this work together. And, you know, that's some of what I want people to experience by coming together, having a Making Miracles party. Literally, it feels good to connect with your friends, to have a meaningful experience that you share with your friends, and then to reach out, to take it and give it forward. You know, I do a lot of work with communities these days as I travel to get them to look at how much help is there for them in their community if people are just willing to reach out. We get so disconnected and so isolated. And when we're in collaboration, in cooperation with a group, we have more resources. You know, we've been talking today about doing the inner work of that and the really out there on the over the edge, you know, metaphysics of it. And yet it's so practical. I often just give communities the instruction to think of anything that they're willing to give away unconditionally to anybody in the room. And then they just post those, a little post-it notes on a board. And suddenly people think, well, wow, this service of mine was so easy to give, and it means so much to somebody else. And look, something I've been desperately needing is just there, free for me to receive from the person I've been sitting next to in church for the last 10 years and never really talked to in any depth. And as we start to make those connections,
life just gets easier. I think that some of the stress we're all feeling is because we're moving into this paradigm where we need to be doing it together and we're still trying to make it all happen ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that's what this whole project is about. And I so hope people will just join in. I'm actually doing a free phone conference tomorrow that'll tell more about it. Anyone who wants, just get on my website, lynnwoodland.com, sign up for the conference. Consider hosting a party. It'll be fun. You have nothing to lose. And, you know, you may just be making a huge difference in your own life and in the lives of people you'll never even know.
Thank you.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that it's sort of, that's the whole basis that we find at SAVE is like it takes everybody to do it. To make it work, and so you're not doing it alone. And you know, say at SAVA, we couldn't operate our programs without the help of everybody who contributes from an individual donor to our partners in the other countries, to the musicians who offer their time to perform and raise the consciousness of SAVA's work and raise funds for us, and the professionals who train people in how, you know, eye care services to the founding members. And it's the big family. We call it the family of SAVA, and we are all dependent on each other to make it work. You know, it's not just one person. And I think for SAVA, we are grateful for every person along the way. If somebody, you know, hands a brochure about SAVA to somebody else, they're as great of the porter as somebody who writes a check for, you know, $1,000. It's all about spreading the word together and creating that awareness. And I think the whole idea of service in groups, it's a wonderful way to share together and to really connect to others and get us outside of our own situation, whatever it is at the time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes just taking that one step away from whatever your problem is that day, it puts a whole different perspective on life.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's quite simple, actually. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, as you said, turning a smile to somebody. That changes everything at that moment. It changes the whole shift in your energy and how you are feeling at that moment. And it's really quite simple.
there's that well-known spiritual teaching story about heaven and hell, where someone is shown hell, and there's people at a banquet table. It's filled to overflowing, but they have these really long spoons, and they can't get the food into their mouths. Then they're shown heaven, and it's the same banquet table, same number of people, same spoons, only everybody is feasting because everybody's feeding each other.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Great.
I love that.
That's great, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a lovely note a lovely vision to hold and to go out with, you know. How much more prosperous we'll all be when we learn to feed each other.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you both so very much for joining us here today on the Alchemy of Light broadcast. And it's really been a pleasure and an honor, because we really are the pioneers. And it's not like we're the first ones out. You know, our ancestors have been at this for many millennia before us. You know, I feel like it was always our destiny to come to this place where we would find love again and know our place in the universe. And we are the pioneers of our day. And I'm so grateful to be connecting with you and sharing in this moment that we are doing this. We are making the stand for what we believe in and really what is important to all of us. And so I'm really grateful that you took time to share this with us. And I'll take this moment to also offer my gratitude to all the ancestors who have gone before us and who, for all the ancestors and the spirit beings that are with us and have joined us here in this broadcast, that we may be all blessed with finding our path of service, with finding that true love, passion in our being that guides us to our highest path of service in the simplest way, to just extending a little kindness, to a more abundant way in the community, if we should be so called to do that. You know, I really thank you both for coming forward, and we're making the world a better place. We are.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I really want to thank Lynn as well for her work that she's doing, and for spreading, you know, the word about working together to be of service together, and bringing people's awareness about Seva's work and all of that. We're just really grateful for this opportunity today. Thank you.
Well, it was fabulous just hanging out with both of you.
Yeah, and I want to plug Lynn's work too. I cannot recommend your book enough, Making Miracles, Creating New Realities for Your Life and Our World. I really cannot recommend that book enough. So if you're listening and have had any move in this, and you're ready to jump in and have a look around at a new way of exploring our vast interconnection, I just hope you pick up that book, because it's a really, really worthwhile, easy read that can transport your whole consciousness, even if you don't try. I really appreciate your work so much as well, and have learned so much in just exploring this, and our time together is really precious. Really.
Thank you, Jamil.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, we're going to get this.
Being with you.
Oh, yes, indeed. Likewise. Absolutely. Okay, guys. Well, whoa, this has been a fantastic 2-hour broadcast. And are there any final comments that before we sign off? Because we're right on the edge now.
Oh, well, you can find out more about Seva at seva.org, right?
Oh, thank you. Yes.
www.seva.org. And that's SEVA.org.
And you can find out about me and the Making Miracles Project and my phone conference tomorrow on my website, lynnwoodland.com. And that's LynnWoodland. And my book, you can find it on Amazon or go to your local bookstore. I always put out a plug for bookstores these days. If you don't see it at your favorite bookstore, just have them order it, because bookstores need our business. They're in trouble these days.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And we will be signing off. I am Jamil Graham, your host of the Alchemy of Light broadcast. Thank you very much, BBS Radio, Doug and Dawn in the back, and Seth on occasion. My love to all of you for making this possible. And you can find out more about the next broadcast and things checking out my profile page here on the bbsradio.com. Or if you're feeling interested in exploring world politics, you can visit my blog at alchemyoflight.org. And thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. And we will see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.